Lecture 9, Pergamum.
Hello and welcome to our ninth lecture today in our series on Alexander and the Hellenistic world. So far we've had an opportunity, after looking at Alexander's career and its aftermath, the wars of the Diadochoi, the wars of the successors, to examine in closer detail two of the kingdoms that came out of the void of a generation of warfare following Alexander's death. We've had a chance to examine the Ptolemaic rule in Egypt, where we've seen a combination of playing Pharaoh to the Egyptians and being a Greek king in his separate Greek capital of Alexandria. And then we've looked also at the Seleucid realm, where the Seleucids were faced by very different problems, that is to say, a large empire with a scattered population. And we've seen that in this realm, the Seleucids presented themselves in very different ways, both as legitimate Babylonian kings and as Greek kings to their Greek audience, and sometimes just ceding territory where necessary. So we've seen different patterns of Hellenistic kingship as the different Hellenistic kingdoms develop. I want to continue a survey of these Hellenistic kingdoms by looking today at one of the most interesting of the Hellenistic kingdoms, that of Pergamum, a city located in what we would now call northwestern Turkey. Pergamum was originally a simple garrison. It does not have an earlier history like that of Egypt. It does not have an earlier history like that of the Seleucid realm, which was essentially the same as the Achaemenid Empire that had come before. Rather, we have a simple dominion based on a single garrison, which will come during the Hellenistic period to embrace all of Asia Minor, the entire region that we would now call Western and Central Turkey. And not only would it come to govern a great deal of territory in the Hellenistic world, it would also exert a cultural influence throughout the Hellenistic period that would rival that of Alexandria. So let's begin by looking at how the kingdom of Pergamum came into existence. And the story is a very interesting one. The kingdom is sometimes called the Attalid kingdom because, as in the case of many of these Hellenistic kingdoms, it takes its name from the ruling dynasty, that of Attalus. The Attalid kingdom of Pergamum was born in the chaos of the wars of the Diadochoi, the successors of Alexander. One of these successors, a general by the name of Lysimachus, had seized control of the region of Thrace, that is to say, the northern Aegean. He held the territory, in other words, that lay between Macedon to the west and Asia Minor to the east. And during the 290s and the 280s, while he was embroiled in various campaigns involving Macedon and Asia Minor, he was able to establish his power across the Hellespont in the territory of Asia Minor by developing and building up a fortress located on a crag at Pergamum. And here he entrusted his garrison to a eunuch by the name of Philotyrus. The site of Pergamum was well chosen because it was high and virtually impregnable. If you go there today and visit the theatre, for example, built on the side of the hill, you'll almost get a nosebleed trying to walk from the bottom at the stage towards the top of the seats because it is built on a very steep slope. Virtually impregnable, and it gave Lysimachus a very powerful base, therefore, for controlling the Asian side of the Hellespont. That's what it was there for. But Lysimachus died in battle, at the Battle of Corypedium in 281 BC. Much of his territory fell to the victor in that battle, Seleucus, the victorious founder of the Seleucid dynasty, the king of the Hellenistic kingdom based in Syria. But despite the fact that Lysimachus had fallen in battle and most of his territory went to Seleucus, Philotyrus remained in control of Pergamum, locked up in his mountain fortress, where he just happened to have a treasure of 9,000 talents of silver, literally a king's ransom. So Philotyrus held out against Seleucus, and Seleucus was never able to capture the city. So that in these events we have the beginning of what will become a kingdom based in Asia Minor. When he died in 263, Philotyrus, of course, had been a eunuch and therefore had no children to succeed him. He left his power and his money to his nephew, Eumenes I. And Eumenes managed to rule in Pergamum for the next 20 years, having defeated in battle Antiochus I, the Seleucid king. so that the Seleucid claim to Pergamum lapsed by the middle of the 3rd century. And before the Attalids declared themselves kings, they had actually ruled independently for at least a generation. From the reign of Philotyrus, back in the 260s, down till the death of the last king of this dynasty, Attalus III, in 133 BC, the Attalid dynasty managed to rule over much of Asia Minor. And their success is particularly remarkable if one considers the fact that there was no kingdom here before them. They had no claim to the control of Pergamon based on inheritance. It hadn't been left to them by an earlier king. There was no territorial integrity here. It didn't correspond to a single satrapy in the Persian Empire, which they could claim to have conquered. It had not come to them by ancestral right. They had not been amongst Alexander's successors. So they were, in terms of the Hellenistic kingdoms, if you like, upstarts. And I think we should ask then, how do these Attalids, who had no legitimacy behind them, who had not conquered territory or inherited it, how did they legitimize their rule? How did they convince the people of Asia Minor to accept them as their kings? And how did they organize that kingdom? These are the questions that deserve to be looked at. Attalid rule was based on generosity. The rulers showered their subjects with gifts. And these gifts were made not just to individuals, but to entire cities. And we have dozens of documents attesting to this, gifts given to include pay for mercenaries. If a city had been having trouble with marauders and needed a mercenary force to help it, they could appeal to the Attalid king and they would often receive a subvention to pay for this. They might be given horses for territorial defense. They were often given tax exemptions during times of hardship. If there were a famine, they might be given direct supplies of oil or of wheat. And even during times of feasting, they might appeal to the king and be given some kind of subvention to hold public festivals. We have one document that I'll read you in relation to Attalid generosity. This dates from the reign of King Eumenes II from 181 BC. And you'll notice as I read through this that we're not talking here about the dealings of a Greek king and a Greek city. This is just a little local village, but they petitioned the king. King Eumenes writes to Artemidorus, "I have read the comments you appended to the petition submitted by the settlers in the village of Kardakes, probably in southwestern Turkey. Since after investigating you find that their private affairs are in a weak condition, as their trees are not yielding much fruit and their land is of a poor quality, give instructions that they may keep the piece of land that they brought from Ptolemy." And it turns out that they haven't paid off the purchase entirely, and he remits the remaining amount of money and pays it himself. And then he goes on to say that he's going to remit their tax burden because they've apparently missed their last 2 years of taxes. I wish the IRS were as generous as this. So he grants them a tax exemption for the next couple of years as well, and if anyone who's fled from the area agrees to return, he also gives them a tax exemption for a couple of years. And then he says, see to it that they provide for repairing the fort that they previously held. Notice again this typical Hellenistic practice of getting the locals to erect a garrison. But here they've let it lapse into disrepair. I myself will pay for a skilled craftsman who will go and repair the fort. So they were very generous throughout their kingdom. And the Attalids did not confine their generosity just to the cities and the villages in Asia Minor. Entire buildings, such as stoas or theatres, were also given by the Attalids to sanctuaries, such as Pezenas up on the Black Sea coast, Delos, which was not a part of their realm, it was not a territory that they actually controlled, and of course Delphi and Athens. So that this dynasty appears to have desired to celebrate its own power and authority by endowing gifts to celebrated Greek cities and sanctuaries back in the islands and on the homeland. And in return, these sanctuaries, by erecting monuments with the names of these kings on them, were giving the dynasty the respect that it craved in the eyes of the Greeks and of the other Hellenistic kingdoms. And you can still go to Athens and to Delos and see buildings that will have the name of Attalos written in huge letters across the top. At Delphi, for example, we have a long inscription that records a generous gift when the Attalid king, Attalus II, gave the city of Delphi and the sanctuary of Apollo 21,000 drachmas. And this money was to be invested in two funds. One fund was to be an investment of 18,000 drachmas, and the interest that that fund gave every year was to be used to pay for public teachers. Public education at Delphi, in the middle of Greece, being paid for by a king in Asia Minor. The other 3,000 drachmas was to be invested, and the interest that it accrued every year was to be used for the holding of an annual festival. This festival was to celebrate the Attalid dynasty, and so it was called the Attalia, the festival in honour of the Attalids. So every Greek who went to Delphi, and every Greek would want to go to Delphi sometime in his life since it was the most important oracle in the Greek world, would see there the evidence of Attalid generosity, and might even be there at the time when a festival was being held where everyone would get to participate in eating the great barbecue that took place, the great feast that was held after a sacrifice. And if any money were left over, Attalus made provision for this money to be lent out by the priests at Delphi, who could become money lenders, accruing about 6.6% interest per year. So this was a generous endowment by the Attalid king, but quite typical. If you want to see a really graphic example of Attalid benefaction and generosity, go to Athens. Because in Athens today, you will see fully re-erected a stoa that was given to the Athenians in the second century. This building was rebuilt in the 1950s by the American School of Classical Studies, and if you have ever seen any pictures of the agora of ancient Athens, and if you've ever wondered how is it that there is one building which seems to be pristine and brand new while everything else is broken down, the reason is it is brand new. It was built only 40 years ago. Built in Athens, this stoa physically links Athens and Pergamum, the cultural centres of the Hellenistic world. And so when Hellenistic kings came to Athens, they were, of course, greeted as if they were heroes, benefactors, coming back in a way to a city which was as much theirs as was Pergamum. We have, in fact, a long description in Polybius, the historian, of the visit by King Attalus I to Athens in the year 200 BC, and we have Attalus arriving, and then we get a description of his actually walking downtown. And this is how the description runs. When he entered the Dipylon Gate, which is located on the northwestern side of the city of Athens, and is the gate leading into the Agora, the major meeting place, the marketplace of Athens, they placed the priestesses and priests on each side of the street. They then opened all the temples, placed victims on all the altars, and asked him to offer sacrifice. So there's a day of celebration with sacrifices going on throughout the city. Finally, they voted him honours greater than they had readily bestowed on any other of their previous benefactors. So a king from Pergamum, now honoured as the greatest benefactor of Athenian history. And this is quite remarkable, something that's never done previously in Athenian history. In addition to other distinctions, they called a tribe after Attalus and enrolled him among the eponymous tribal heroes. The Athenian civic body was divided into 10 tribes, but now one of them will be named for Attalus. It is as if retroactively he's being made one of the founder heroes of the city of Athens. This is a remarkable insight into the relationship between the Attalid dynasty and the rest of the Greek world. They wished to portray themselves as, in a way, the embodiment of Athenian culture. And the very Acropolis at Pergamum was really modelled to look like the Acropolis of Athens. It is as if old Athens is looking at new Athens, the two talking to each other, and the links between the two made more concrete by the Attalids then sending masons and money to Athens to build buildings there to make the cities even more similar to each other. In their dealings with the Greek cities within their domain, the Attalids maintained the fiction that their cities were independent and autonomous rather than cities within the realm of the Attalids. And this was true to a certain degree local cities did continue, for example, to appoint their local magistrates and the minor officials. We have long documents from these cities talking about officials who were in charge of the waterworks and the sewers and the street cleaning and so forth. So at the municipal level, life continued much as it had gone on before. But it's quite clear that the real power in the Attalid realm lay in the hands of the ruler. And this is dramatically illustrated in the documents that we have from the city of Pergamum itself. There's one famous inscription from Pergamum, I won't read you the whole thing now, but I'll summarize it, where Eumenes writes to the city and he says that there are some generals who for the last year have been serving in office and have done a very fine job. They managed to balance the budget, they managed to pay off some debts, and they did all of the sacred obligations quite well and piously. And so what the king, Eumenes, does is to say, I've decided to award some honorific crowns to these generals, and he says, perhaps you might like to consider doing the same thing as well. So it's phrased in terms of advice from a king to a city within his realm. And it's not until we read the response that's on the same inscription from the city, and the response is that they will offer honours to these generals, that we find out that the generals being honoured had been appointed by Eumenes in the first place. The whole thing was a farce. The whole thing was a charade. They weren't real commanders of the Pergamene army at all. They were local magistrates who were responsible for running the city's revenues. They were the accountants of the city. They'd been appointed by the king, and because they'd done a good job, the king had rewarded them, and then he'd recommended that the city reward them as well. But the entire thing is framed as if, as an outside benefactor, he's merely advising the city to honour these men for a job well done. In other words, Pergamum's autonomy was a polite fiction that existed only in the diplomacy between king and subject. What makes this even more remarkable is to consider that what lay at the top of the Acropolis of Pergamum, this city built on many tiers, what lay at the top were the palaces of the king himself. So that this isn't a letter from an outside advisor to some distant city. It's a letter that's been sent down from the top of the hill to the bottom of the hill, saying, they did a good job, now say thank you to them. The real power of the Attalids rested on the judicious use of military force. I've talked about their generosity. Okay, that's the velvet glove, but now here's the iron fist. The judicious use of military force, and as in many Hellenistic kingdoms, they relied particularly on mercenaries rather than local armies. Why? Because there was always a danger that a standing army made up of local populations would develop nationalistic tendencies, asserting its own authority, resisting the outside rule of a Greco-Macedonian dynasty. The Egyptians are at no time weaker, the Ptolemies in Egypt are at no time weaker than when in the Battle of Raphia they rely upon Egyptian troops to help them. And this leads to a series of revolts in the years after. So these Greco-Macedonian monarchs are not stupid. They recognize that, generally speaking, you must not put arms into the hands of the local population. You must rely on mercenaries. These mercenaries will be loyal to the monarch, and they will also serve as the administrators of the kingdom. So rather than relying on a national army, which may agitate, Eumenes enters into an elaborate contract with his mercenaries, and we have the details of this particular contract as well, which gives us an astonishing eyewitness account of how a Hellenistic king deals with his mercenary forces. In this contract that we have, Eumenes sets out the exact pay scale so that every man will know if he signs up how much he's going to get. There is an agreement that they will only have to campaign for 10 months out of the year, so they're negotiating for their 2 months vacation as well. He even makes arrangements for the care of orphans. So we're not just talking here about a few hundred individual soldiers who've come from Greece. We're talking about men who've lived here for a long time, who have wives, who have children, entire families, almost private armies, if you will. So we get the care of the orphans being taken care of. They are offered tax concessions. So they'll be tax exempt while they're working for him. And there's also an agreement about back pay, because apparently Eumenes had slipped in the payments of his mercenaries over the last few months. In return for this, the mercenaries are expected to swear an oath of loyalty to Eumenes and are prepared to fight to the death. The mercenaries also swear to guard any of the cities or the fortresses or any of the money that's been entrusted to them. And the contract reveals an elaborate system, not so much of civil bureaucracy, but rather of military commands. And the focus here is not on the state, it is not on the kingdom, or even the city of Pergamum, it is on the man, King Eumenes, so that his authority is recognized by this army, and he it is to whom they swear their loyalty. Now, what we find then is that in the early phase of Attalid kingship, there is a strong emphasis on the personal authority of the king, and we could call this a kind of simple autocratic rule, which is obviously necessary since there was no prior legitimacy to account for their controlling this kingdom. But in the middle of the, in the latter part, excuse me, of the 3rd century and the early part of the 2nd century, the Attalids were able to transform their control of this kingdom into something new, into a kind of legitimate kingship. And it comes about during the reign of Attalus I, the Attalid king who visited Athens and whose visit I read a moment ago. The precise circumstances involving this shift in Attalid kingship are that early in his reign, in the 240s, King Attalus witnessed the invasion of Asia Minor by the Gauls, a Celtic people. Some of them would stay in Asia Minor, establishing a kingdom called Galicia. We know from the letters of Paul that some of his letters are written to the Galatians. There is also a Galicia in Spain, where some of the Gauls end up, and of course they end up in the area we now call France. They were involved in periodic migrations during the course of the 5th, 4th and 3rd century, which had led them to invade parts of Greece. At one stage they sacked Delphi, they even got to Rome, and before moving even further west and ending up in France and Spain. Two branches of these invasions by these Gallic tribes, one branch led by the Tolistoagian Celts and another led by the Tectosagian Celts or Gauls, arrived in Asia Minor in the 230s. And in these battles, Attalus was completely victorious, and at around the same time he also defeated his Seleucid rivals, Antiochus Hierax, Antiochus the Hawk as he was known, and Seleucus III. Now, as a result of these victories, Attalus was able to erect victory monuments celebrating his glorious military successes. The monuments that he erects date to the 220s BC, and here King Attalus now styles himself king, while downplaying the titles and the authority of his opponents, Antiochus and Seleucus. So it has taken quite some time. The Attalids have been in control of Pergamum since about the 280s, but now, after two generations of control, they are in a position to assert legitimate authority, proclaiming themselves king. Why? Because they have saved Pergamum from the Gauls. For nearly a century, Pergamum was ruled by only three men from one dynasty, and by the end of that time, these rulers could claim to be kings, based on the fact that they had defended Pergamum from a foreign foe. Now, this victory over the Gauls, over the Celts, became a kind of linchpin in the propaganda of the Attalid dynasty. It was in celebrating these victories that they presented themselves as the great defenders of Greek civilization. We've already seen how Attalus wanted to make Pergamum be the Asian equivalent of Athens, to in fact replicate the city over in Asia Minor. Now, thanks to his victory over the Gauls, he's able to maintain that he is the representative of Greek order against the threat of a foreign invasion, in much the same way as earlier the Athenians had been able to maintain that their victory over the Persians had also been a victory of order over foreign invasion. So barbarian chaos has been put to rout, and an Attalid king can proclaim himself the savior of Greek culture. There is one irony to all of this, and that is that the statues which were made to celebrate these victories seem to glorify the defeated as much as the victors. Now, some of you may have seen examples of these sculptures of the dying Gaul. There is one that shows the Gaul spread-eagled on the ground as he's about to expire from his wounds. Another where a Gallic chieftain has his wife crooked in his arm. She's already died as a result of the defeat, and so he's now in the process of stabbing himself. In a way, the Attalids understood that you could make your victory somehow even more poignant if you made your enemy into a noble enemy, an enemy a victory over whom made you even more noble. By 133 BC, even the power of Pergamum and its kings was unable to withstand the inexorable advance of Roman power, and that we're going to be dealing with in a lecture later on in the series. Greece and the Hellenistic kingdoms would alternate in the second century between alliances with and rebellions against Rome. But throughout this period, which will be the swan song of Hellenism politically, the period when the Hellenistic states will eventually come under Roman control, Pergamum remained the most steadfast of Rome's allies in the East. And this meant that when Rome confronted the power of the Seleucid king Antiochus III early in the 3rd century, for example, Pergamum was well placed to benefit from the superpower matchup between the Seleucid king from Syria and the power of Rome from the west. Antiochus was defeated in 189 BC at the Battle of Magnesia, and in that battle he lost virtually all of his holdings in Asia Minor. He was forced to sign a peace treaty the following year with the Romans, the so-called Treaty of Apamea, and this treaty made him cede all of his territory north of the Taurus Mountains. Who received it? The Attalids. Their reward for being steadfast Roman allies was that they were given territories that embraced all of Asia Minor. And then the remarkable ending of the story of their independent kingdom is that in 133 BC, when Attalus III died without a successor, he bequeathed his entire kingdom to the Romans rather than see it be torn apart by civil dissension. So that dramatically, at one stroke, the Hellenistic kingdom of Pergamum became the Roman province of Asia Minor. Now, there is one last aspect of Pergamum which I want to mention, although it's somewhat discreet from the elements we've been talking about earlier, and that is a particular monument which is still to be seen today now in Berlin, that is to say, the Great Altar of Pergamum. People often wonder, where does it fit in with this larger narrative of Pergamene history? And the answer is that the monument is a graphic illustration of the way that under the Attalids, Pergamum was proclaiming itself both a living embodiment of the Greek past and a suggestion of the Greek future. This great altar has on it a frieze running around all sides. This is the so-called telephos frieze. And the story that's told here in sculpture is that of the founder hero of Pergamum, the character derived from Greek myth, who was supposed to have been brought to Pergamum and to have established the city. So by putting this on their frieze, what the Pergamenes are doing, and the Attalids in particular are doing, is attempting to say, well, yes, we may have been founded by Philotyrus, and we may be a garrison from the Seleucid Empire that's become independent, but really what we are is a good Greek city with the same kind of foundation story as any other Greek city, whether it be Sparta or Corinth or Athens. So in a way, there was an attempt here to make them like the rest of the Greek world and the older Greek world by connecting with Greek mythology. But what we'll find on the rest of this altar is a whole new approach to the representation of myth and of history, the like of which has never been seen before. Because in this altar, you actually walk up steps from the ground level to the top to take part in any sacrifices going on. And as you walk up the steps on either side of you, you will find cut in deep relief sculptural figures showing the victory of the gods over various giants and beasts and monsters. These are cut in deep relief so that they're almost they're almost completely freestanding sculptures, and they are as large as the people walking up the steps. So that in Pergamum, you actually enter into history. It doesn't merely advertise history for you to look at from a distance, as if you were looking at the Parthenon in Athens. But now there is a whole new approach to the representation of identity and to inviting people into that history as you walk into the monument and actually witness the battles, the great battles between chaos and order that have characterized Greek history going on right around you. And this is done vividly to mark the fact that in Pergamum, you are entering the place where once again, but most recently for the Hellenistic world, order has been established over chaos. And that battle, which has been going on psychologically at the heart of Greek culture forever, is now being appropriated by Pergamum to make itself both the embodiment of Greek culture and the latest expression of that Greek culture in a new and modified Hellenistic form.